Okay, everybody, welcome to the show. Gideon, how's it going this week, man?
Going good, man. I just saw Dune in IMAX. Got to show my dad Dune. So that was sweet. That was my fourth and final time. Probably not gonna watch that movie for like 2 years. But I was happy to show it to him. It was a good time. There was somebody behind me after like the opening. They're like, "Oh, their eyes are blue because of the spice." I was like, "Jesus Christ!" Like, what? I was like, "You're in the IMAX. Like, what are you doing? Like, who did you drag here that doesn't know what's going on?" Like, it was just
So,
funny.
is your dad familiar with Dune previously?
He's seen the 1984 version.
Okay.
He was telling me about that, and I don't think he's read the book. And he saw the first one with me as well, of the new ones.
Gideon, I've only ever met your dad one time, and that was at your third grade birthday party, which was pirate themed, and we all watched Treasure Planet. It was totally
So awesome.
badass.
That's
Yeah, and your
so
dad was like
funny.
talking in pirate speak the entire time. It was
That sounds
awesome.
like my
Yeah,
dad.
it was sweet. All right, Neil, how's it going this week, man? Nice. Yeah, and you just had a very salty game of Helldivers tonight, as I understand it. Yeah. I can completely relate on the anxiety inducing. We're going to New York City just for a small weekend trip on Friday, and I had accidentally double booked myself where one of my bands is supposed to have a gig on Friday, so I had to find a replacement bass player, and that replacement bass player dropped out yesterday. So I had to scramble and get on Craigslist and offer to pay somebody a bunch of money to come and fill in, and it was an extremely anxiety-inducing event to get them to like sign up for. Not only you got to get to a rehearsal, but you got to get to a gig. It's going to be 3 hours. Here's 30 songs. Here's all your equipment. It just like getting all that organized and like getting them organized like with the band. And musicians are notoriously unreliable, and especially bass players are really unreliable. So it's like. It was just.
Just a question. How much more or less expensive would it have been to like fly me to wherever you're going? Let me borrow your bass and then just like make sure that my amp is just not even turned on. Like it's not even plugged in. And I just plug in.
It's still probably. I like the idea. I like where your head's at, but it probably still would have been more expensive than what I'm paying out of my own pocket to get this Craigslist guy.
Are you playing Rush songs or something? I mean, do you even need a
No.
bass player?
Well, I kind of suggested that to our guitar player. I was like, why not just get an octave pedal and see how things go? And they weren't super into that idea. Anyway, we got it sorted out. Anyway, things are fine now. But I totally understand on the anxiety. I've had a very anxious week too in that particular regard. Alex Prince, how's it going this week, man?
Staying alive, Sam. I think it's good, weekend in New York, there's not that much to see there, and any longer you'd run out of things to do, so.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I think we're just going to eat a couple strombolis, get some pizza, get some bagels, and then, bounce before we,
We should
before it gets to be too much.
start a club for Coastal Elites. I'm going to San Francisco next week for work, so.
Oh, wow. Cool. Yeah. Well, you know
Me
what they say, West Coast, best coast. I've actually never been to California.
neither.
I've only been I guess I've been, this will be my third trip, working for a company in California. We'll do that to you.
Yeah, and how is San Francisco when you land? Is your plane overrun by the liberal hordes like 28 like World War Z?
Totally fine. The city when I went first was actually very empty because it was just as like the tail end of COVID lockdown.
Oh yeah, sure.
It was actually one of the most bizarre experiences of my life. Here's like the only thing, my main observation about San Francisco is it has so many restaurants and so many incredibly specific restaurants. Like, we do a fusion of these three cuisines, or we only serve pear ciders at this bar, or something like that.
Right.
We specialize in 20 different pear ciders.
Right.
And then like to have all of that and have no one there, I'm like, how could this possibly exist?
Right. That is what I've heard about Portland, is that you can open up a store in Portland that just sells like spoons, right? And you'll come back 3 years later and they're still in business miraculously, like doing almost no business. The store is still completely open and totally
not
fine.
Not just spoons, but like free-range, cruelty-free spoons.
Right, yeah. I've never been there. My only reference for San Francisco really is through the movie Vertigo. And obviously it has changed quite a bit in the last 70 years. It is no longer the Alfred Hitchcock San Francisco. We should get to that movie at some point on this podcast.
We should do Vertigo. We should do Birds.
Yeah,
we could do a Hitchcock month. I would be totally down for that. I mean, we did Nicolas Cage. We can do Alfred Hitchcock. I think artistically they're about on the same.
Can we really stoop to Hitchcock after covering the
great some of those Cage episodes are some of the best episodes we've done. I maintain that. Anyway, so we're here this week to talk about Uncut Gems, which came out in, looks like, 2019. Another A24 banger. Oh, speaking of stooping to artistic levels, like, are we really going to do Hitchcock after exploring the greatest actor of our time, Adam Sandler?
Oh, man. You know, I got to say, I mean, well, we can get into it, but this is one of his great performances.
So, previous to this, what was everybody's favorite Adam Sandler movie?
Click.
Ooh.
I like Click too, and I think it should have ended with him dying out in the street, and then it should have just cut to credits, and it would have been a downer, but it would have been like a really it would have been poignant. It would have been like, yeah, don't fast forward and don't waste your life, you know. If he wouldn't have woken up in the Bed Bath and Beyond, it would have been like really like a really kind of heady movie.
I like, I don't know if it's my favorite, but I like Little Nicky a lot. That one's funny. It's just ridiculous. That's just the one I can think of off the top of my head. I haven't seen too many of his in a long time, honestly.
I saw Little Nicky in theaters with friend of the pod, Andy Holston, when we were like 14.
Dude, and, nice.
Oh, man.
We watched Mr. Deeds a lot, and Happy Gilmore was big in our house.
Hey, he made like a bunch of totally serviceable comedies before he kind of went into like the movie-cation phase.
Yeah. Yeah, but you know, God bless him. I think, when I was 14 and, an internet edgelord, I was really anti-Adam Sandler. And now I'm starting to, I kind of appreciate that, like, for a while he just wanted to make like funny movies for 12-year-old boys. You know, and just, he would just go on vacation with his buddies and shoot a movie while they were doing it, like, all, and just keeps in touch with all his old SNL friends. And then every once in a while he does like a real movie. He does like The Wedding Singer, Punch Drunk Love, or he does Uncut Gems. And, you know, like, was he nominated for an Academy Award for this movie? I don't know.
Off the top of my head.
I read it in his Wikipedia page. He went on like Howard Stern and said if he didn't get an award for this movie, he would go and make the worst film he's ever made in retaliation. Which I don't think he did. So
that's awesome.
Wait for the shoe to drop.
Yeah. Anyway, so Uncut Gems is our movie this week. In 2019, A24, everybody's favorite art house modern production company, especially Gideon's. I feel like three or four of your favorite movies are A24 movies. So Gideon, give me your background with this movie and why you brought it to the podcast.
So this is a movie by the Safdie brothers. I think it is maybe their third film, and I had heard a lot of buzz about their previous movie Good Time with Robert Pattinson.
Yep.
I would screw up his last name, but and I saw that, really liked Good Time. I would love to get to that at some point. And then when this came out, I heard a lot of buzz about this. Heard it was just like really great. So I think we got the Blu-ray when it came out and watched it. Just totally loved it. Man, I'm just like blown away by it. It's such a unique movie. The more that I've like learned about it, I heard it took like 10 years to make, and it seems like it's such an interesting personal movie for these brothers to make, and it's like full of stuff that I don't usually gravitate towards too much, but
yeah,
I just can't help but love it.
Why do you say it's personal to the brothers?
Because so I guess their dad was, he was like an I think their whole family was avid like basketball fans, and I think his dad was like a jeweler or like a salesperson.
Yeah.
So I don't know if like they're pulling from that. I don't think Adam Sandler's character is necessarily like his their dad per se.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and like their Jewish faith and everything is yeah.
Yeah. That sense of identity is definitely all over this movie. Alex Princeton, what was your history with this? What did you know going into it?
No history with this movie other than my, you know, knowledge of Sandler. I think maybe I saw a preview with Sandler in this character, and I just knew that it had a reputation for being one of his like better non-comedic performances, or
yeah.
Semi-comedic anyway.
Yeah, yeah. How about
I mean,
you?
I actually read this as a very, very serious film. With a few moments of levity sprinkled in.
Okay, sure. Neil.
Yeah, I feel like this might have come out late 2019 because I feel like this was a movie everybody was watching during like the first COVID lockdown.
Yeah.
But apart from like being aware of it existing, I don't have any history with it.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean. Yeah, I was largely the same. All I knew it was that it was A24, Adam Sandler. It was a dramatic role, and I knew that they dropped the F-bomb like 5,000 times in this movie. Like that was all that I knew, that it like broke the record for most F-bombs ever dropped in a movie, which I think is probably true.
I didn't know that. Well,
yeah. Well, I mean, it's like almost every. I'm not turning my nose up at it. I'm just saying that like it is almost every sentence. Like when you, especially in some, it was some of the, I say some of the more intense scenes. Like not every scene in this movie is almost incredibly intense, but almost all of them are. So I think where to start with this movie is that it's basically, it's not really about one deal by this New York jeweler and gambling addict. It's about, you know, basically like a week or 2 weeks of time in the life of this guy, Howard Ratner, who is constantly like making deals and then betting the money and then promising to pay people back. And just he's constantly screaming into his phone, basically, and constantly getting himself into these horribly tense situations with organized crime and loan sharks and betting agents. And he's cheating on his wife and with like one of the gals that works at his store. And so it is a very anxiety inducing movie. The base, I guess, if there's one single plot through line, it would be that he gets this really valuable giant cluster of opals sent over from Africa and is going to put it up for auction. And it's a lot of the movie is about him having the opal and then not having it and then trying to get it back and then putting it up for auction and getting it again and just kind of the drama surrounding that. But basically it's just, I would describe this movie more as just it's not about the minute plot. It's more about like the character, just getting into this character's head and watching him operate. And it's about one, well, I don't want to say one, but it's really about Adam Sandler's performance and just watching him act his ass off. So I think we kind of start there. Adam Sandler's awesome in this movie.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, I want to hear your guys' thoughts first, because I mean, I've seen this multiple times. I really, really like this. This is one of my top movies, probably. So I'm curious what you guys have to say about it.
I just think he's still him. You know, and he's still like a very Adam Sandler type character. But I think the credit really goes to the person who cast him in this role, because he's just so pitch perfect, anxious and funny and a total bastard, but still kind of likable in a weird way. I come away from this movie still really liking that character. And I know that I shouldn't. I mean, he's reprehensible in so many ways, but even during that last scene when he's like watching the game and he's got all the goons like locked in the thing, I'm like, I really want the Celtics to win. You know, I want this guy to hit that parlay. I want him to get all the money, even though he's a total bastard. So I was
cheering along with him at the moments of that game where I was like, yes, they got the tip, you know, and just maybe that's the sports fan in me. I think Sandler plays a guy who is like overconfident very well. And that's maybe like in essence what this guy is. He really truly believes he can keep pulling it off over and over, you know, despite all the evidence. We get to see a really telling moment of weakness near the end of the film there, which I think Sandler delivers very well. And then we watch him like turn around and catch the bug again. My comp for this film, and maybe even for the performance, is it is Leaving Las Vegas, because I think we see a deep and sincere portrayal of an addict at his best and worst, with those like brief moments of lucidity. And the tone of this is happier than Leaving Las Vegas overall, maybe until even up to the very end. I think we're seeing like a masterclass performance again from an actor I wouldn't have expected it from of addiction.
Yeah, he's
well said, Alex.
He's totally phenomenal, and you're right. I think like the contrast between those really low moments and those really high moments, like there's a low moment like right after he gets clocked in the face by organized crime. He's
crying in his secretary's.
Yeah, it's everything
sucks. I don't know what her role is. But.
Yeah, nothing's working out and everything sucks. And then like 3 minutes later, he's on top of the world again. So you really ride the roller coaster with this character. Neil, how'd you feel about Adam Sandler in this movie?
Okay, so I think I'm gonna have a controversial take here.
Go for it.
I thought it worked. I don't think that this was actually that big of a stretch for Adam Sandler.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, just think about, like, any of his, like, dumber comedies, like Happy Gilmore. He just has to scream the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a slight shift. I think it's good casting in that somebody
recognized it.
Oh, Adam Sandler could actually do this, and it's not that big of a pull. You could transplant his character into a Happy Gilmore production, I think. Except in that movie, it would be funny when he gets the shit beaten out of him. Just a few tweaks, and this is a Happy Gilmore production in a lot of ways.
Interesting.
But those tweaks are at important junctions enough to turn this into a drama. But I was like physically anxious watching this movie. Alex and I watched together with his wife, and I was like clutching at one of Alex's couch pillows, just like, oh my god, can they just stop talking? Can they just stop? Can we just have a minute of silence? I just need to collect myself. And it never came.
Maybe I'm sick, Neil, but I didn't get any of that anxiety at all. And in fact, as soon as the last scene was over, my first impulse was to open DraftKings and put some money on the Nuggets.
That's so funny. Dude.
Sports gambling is illegal.
It just keeps going. Like, I don't know how many. There are maybe a couple of minutes where the dialogue slows down.
Mm-hmm. There are a few scenes where they do give you a break, like when after his girlfriend gets caught with the weekend, there's a moment there where like she's walking away, and then they kind of have a quiet moment there. Or when he's locked in the trunk of the car, there's get a little bit of echo here. Oh no, we're good. Okay, when he's locked in the trunk of the car, there's a little bit of a respite, and like once he gets punched in the face, you know, things calm down for a second. So there, I agree that this movie is extremely anxious, and it's a long runtime, you know, 2 hours, 15 minutes, and it doesn't feel like it because it's just go, 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 go. And
I'm going to just cut in there. I'm just saying,
yeah.
I felt every minute. Like,
really?
I don't think it needed to be shorter, mm-hmm. but it felt like I felt the 2 hours and 15 minutes of this movie. I was like, it's still going.
Like, mm-hmm. Right.
There's just like so much energy, negative or positive, just cranking.
Yeah.
Are we done? Can we be done?
Right. I totally understand. Do you mean that in a negative way, Neil? Like it negatively impacted your enjoyment of the movie? Right.
I'm not saying that, like, and to be clear, I'm not saying it's bad.
Right.
I think that the desired effect is for you to feel like anxious.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it succeeded there.
100%.
For me, but like, and so yeah, I don't think I can answer that question effectively. It's just.
No, I understand.
Are we
you know, you don't enjoy this movie in the same way that you don't, like, really enjoy Eraserhead, right? It's not like, wee, you know, I'm having such a great time. It's extremely effective at what it's trying to do, and that one thing is make you as tense and anxious as possible. I think something that contributes greatly to this is the score of this movie, which
love
kicks ass.
Love
the soundtrack rips. It's all like synthy and kind of industrial and shit. Gideon, you want to talk about that?
Yeah, and just to mention too, their previous movie, very similar soundtrack, and has one of my favorite ending songs in a movie that I've seen in recent years. Yeah, I love the electronic, almost like dreamy, like 80s kind of ethereal music that we get, especially in the book ending, like zoom in and zoom out shots. For in the beginning of, and the end of the movie, it really adds to the style and the flashiness, I feel like, of the whole movie. And the film, like, I guess the directors were like determined to get the shot on 35mm. They took a pay cut for that.
Yeah.
To mention about the casting of Adam Sandler, I guess his wife had seen their previous movie, Good Time, read the script for this, was like, you have to do it. And I guess he usually takes home like 20 million, Adam Sandler, in a movie,
mm-hmm.
or for his role or whatever, and the whole budget of this movie was 19 million. So I know I'm going on, but it's just like such a bizarre passion project that they take so much from so many different places. And like, even the basketball games are all real life basketball games that
I wondered about that, especially Garnett's speech at the end, which seems to fit quite well thematically, but it's not like he mentions a stone or anything specific to the movie. You could almost see a world where, like, they saw that speech from Kevin Garnett and then the movie came into being.
Yeah, but, I wasn't sure about that part, like, when he's given that speech, if that was also from a game, but I assume so, but I'm not 100% sure on that part specifically. So,
interestingly, they considered, I think, a couple of basketball players for this, and Garnett was not choice number one, but he was like number two.
Okay.
That is something I wanted to point out as well, is that I thought for sure, like, Kevin Garnett was going to have like 5 seconds of screen time, then he was going to bounce. He's so good in this movie.
Yeah,
I thought he was great. Like, I really enjoyed a lot of the scenes that he was in.
He didn't, like, blow me away, but it's probably the best performance I've ever seen by an athlete. Like,
that's what I mean.
Yeah, agreed. I want to see more. I was like, that was crazy.
He's not Daniel Day-Lewis, but he's better than, like, Michael Jordan in Space Jam. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It was, you know, low bar, but... Or, what's that movie with Shaq in it? Shaq is a genie.
God, what's that called?
Shaq genie. I think it's Shazam.
Nice.
I've never
Kazam.
Oh, Kazam. Damn.
Okay, apparently Sinbad, the black comedian, was in a movie called Shazam. Mm. Shaq was in a movie called Kazam. Something like that. I don't know.
Shaq Fu, is that just a game?
Shaq Fu is just the Super Nintendo game.
Okay, gotcha.
A bunch of poor bastard kids wasted their Christmas money on. Anyway, what?
Garnett played an excellent second, and better than some, like, quote-unquote real actors out there. let's see. Yeah, I do wonder. So all the basketball games were real, huh? And they just cut together games that made sense?
Yeah, because I think they were working on it for a long time, and they're just trying to, like, secure funding for the movie, so they've just been building it, and they're just such big fans of basketball. And I think they wanted to use that, the games be real, for the betting that he was doing specifically for the character. So,
Yeah, I mean, it worked out great. I mean, it was totally, I was on the edge of my seat the entire time watching that final basketball game and all the stuff that was going on at the casino at the same time. I mean, I don't think I've been that nervous watching a movie since I watched like Rear Window or something like that, just in the power of the movie to like draw you in and just, you know,
it's,
for lack of a better word, give you the clenched butthole feeling, you know, like nothing like it.
It's such a shocking, like, organized chaos movie that's just like a literal roller coaster thrill ride, like you were saying, with the emotions. And that's what I noticed too on this watch. I think I haven't seen it for a few years, but when I came out, I'd watched it multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so much emotionality too in the movie. Like, emotionality is ultimately like Howard's downfall and what gets him into a lot of these things. Even how he like reacts to the different women in his life, whether it's like mm-hmm. lashing out at Julia or like trying to win back his wife when she's just like laughing in his face and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And how it's like that guy that he trapped at the end, in that weird doorway, you could tell like he just decided like 15, 20, 30 minutes ago, whatever it was, like, as soon as I'm out of here, he's fucking done, you know.
Did any of you think that Adam Sandler was going to make it out of this movie alive?
I hope he would.
I didn't think he was going to either. Go ahead, Neil.
I can be really brief. For a while, I was rooting for it, and then I think as you get closer and closer to the end, you get this picture that things are closing in on it. Go ahead, Neil.
I was just going to say that, I thought it was an interesting red herring. At the beginning, you start with his colonoscopy.
The cancer, yeah.
And I think, you expect that to come back in like a, like, okay, like you're massively in debt, you've got all these problems, your marriage is falling apart, and now you've got cancer, and this is like your rallying cry moment, like, I'm going to get my shit together, I'm going to beat this, blah, blah, blah. And then instead, it's like, again, people are just screaming at him while he's getting the news from his doctor that he's fine, like there's no issues.
Man, is that supposed to be a thing where you look back and think, if on that phone call they had said, you have cancer, would it have actually turned out better for him?
Maybe, but I think, so here's my take. And so I think there's something to be said in there about, you think he's, like, it sets him up to die of a disease, a physical disease, but in the end it was his mental disease that kills him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. I like that, Neil.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I
felt that as soon as he was enclosed in the jewelry store by himself, even though he had those guys locked in that room, since all the other employees had been cleared out by the screenplay, I felt like he wasn't coming out of the ending of this movie alive. Like, I thought there was a good chance he was going to make it out until he was alone with the criminals, and I was like, sorry, bud, something's going down here.
Well, and it's crazy too, because he totally would be fine, right? Like, he is fine, he has the money to pay back Arno, everything could be fine, but then he's like, let me make this crazy bet with all the money and get the money out the window to my mistress or whatever so she can do this bet.
And that's the picture of disease, right? Like, he has many moments where he could pull himself out. I will say, you know, it's interesting. It's a fun twist when it turns out that Arno is like his relative and you see them across from each other at that dinner. And it's interesting, Sam, because throughout the whole film, the sharks actually show quite a bit of restraint.
Yeah. And
I think Arno is even ready probably to forgive him. It's his associate who... I think it's just because Sandler throughout the film treats other people so terribly. And at the end, that's his comeuppance, because like this guy of all the guys, he's really rubbed the wrong way. Nico, was it?
Some Eastern European mobster.
Something about like you can only get away so long being an asshole, you know?
Right.
And then he gets it.
You know who I felt bad for was the battery inside Adam Sandler's iPhone in this movie. That dude runs his fucking phone into the dirt every day, screaming into that thing. You know, nobody uses their cell phone more than Adam Sandler in this movie, I feel.
Dude, I love the way he shows that, like, YouTube video in the beginning. It's just so, like, just the mannerisms about it are so funny to me. It's like my dad showed me something.
Yeah, what was the YouTube video he was showing him? Oh, just about the opal, right?
About, yeah, the miners in Ethiopia and, like, okay. And the African Jews, right?
I that's got to be symbolic of something, right? Is the people mining the ore are Jewish, and the people selling the ore are Jewish, and they're selling it for a gazillion times more than what they paid the miners for.
I mean, there's actually some dual symbolism there, because there's a lot of like crossover between the African American and Jewish communities as well. So they're black Jews. Mm. Something about quote unquote, why are Jews so into basketball? He gets asked.
Right.
I can't tell you what it is, and I hesitate to speculate because I don't want to.
Well, I think that's more of like, I would say that's more of an urban thing, right? Is that like there's no room for a baseball diamond in the big city or a football field, right? But you can have a basketball hoop on every corner, and largely, I mean, the largest Jewish population in the U.S. by far is concentrated in New York City. And
yeah, you know, I'm referring specifically to the line where maybe Damani asks, why are you Jews so into basketball?
Right.
And Sandler says, you know, the first basketball player to score in the NBA was a Jew.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I didn't know that. I don't even know if that's true, but
he says that in the film. Anyway, there's another, maybe while we're on the topic of symbolism and Judaism, the Safdie brothers said, this is just something I read, that they played up every negative Jewish stereotype to the max in Sandler's character. And they did that they did that deliberately, and they wanted him to own it, like, proudly.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
I was going to say that there's, like, no likable characters in this movie. Like, I think the closest you come is maybe his youngest son, who's just disappointed in him.
But, yeah.
Like, I mentioned this to Alex after watching. Like, so, you know, Sandler is, like, not stereotypical in, like the worst sense, but, yeah, a lot of stereotypes get played up. But, like, pretty much every Jewish character is, like, you know, runs into those on some level. The African-American community doesn't come in very well either in this. And in particular, I was really surprised that Kevin Garnett, you know, playing himself, also, like, comes off as, like, not a great person.
Mm.
And, like, just in, like, a modern celebrity thing where it's, like, all about image, like, I don't know basketball very well, but I never got the impression that he was, like a villain-esque character during his prime. And so just to see him, like, you know, do something where he, you know, is playing himself and he's not coming off super well, it was, like, very interesting to me. Because, like, a lot of times you get those, like, celebrity bit parts where, like, you know, they're trying to, like, maintain their image, and his was just not there.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. Again, I think,
yeah,
I think Kevin Garnett is to be commended for his performance in this movie. You know, like, maybe not a great performance by the standards of, you know, great Hollywood performances, but certainly as a, but certainly more than a cameo, you know, certainly way more than I thought we were going to get out of Kevin Garnett in this. So props to, you know, playing a great part in a really excellent movie.
I just want to touch on more of the acting, just with the whole cast. I feel like everybody does such a good job in this movie. I'd say The Weeknd is probably, like, the weakest actor, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
He's not even really in it too much.
Yeah, his part is so brief.
It's so minor. So,
They had the dad from Good Times who showed up for a cameo for 2 seconds there. That was cool.
Yeah, that's so funny. And even I don't know if it's both of them or just one of them, but the the guy that holds the Celtic ring for him, like, he's like an actual jeweler. So they got like some like people from that real jeweler world and put him in the movie, which is always dope to see that kind of thing.
Actually, I have a small personal connection with this movie. So when the first time I ever went to New York City was with my dad, probably in 2011, 2012. And we walked through, not knowing what it was, we walked through the middle of the Diamond District, which is where this movie takes place, and didn't know what it was until after we were already through and did the research on where the hell we were. But there were Hasidic Jews walking between all the different buildings with their, I don't know what the proper term for them, but they wear the coats, like the dark coats with the pockets in them. And later learned that they were these guys often walk between all these different stores with like hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of diamonds in their pockets, just like making exchanges by hand and running back and forth between all the different stores. But yeah, I mean, it's obviously the Diamond District is a real place, but just seeing all the crazy shit that goes down there in person, it was pretty eye opening.
I was chatting with a coworker today and mentioned I had seen Uncut Gems. He lives in New York, and he has shopped in the Diamond District. And he says it's this very interesting network of, like, individual business owners. And oftentimes, like, if you don't know somebody or have a family connection, you can't even get in the door to do business. It's, like, very strange or very interesting, like, way of doing business that you can only really support in a place like New York.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, this is almost off topic a little bit, but I mean, there, New York City is the kind of place where there are entire streets of stores where
that are any, like, almost ecosystem, like a biological, like,
right. I mean, but there are stores and things like that in New York City where any of us would have to empty our entire bank account to get one small item at that store. That was obviously not worth, well, I suppose the true price of an item is what anybody is willing to pay for it, as we learned in the movie Nightcrawler. But, you know, like, if you want a scarf from Burberry, you know, it's like a $4,000 scarf or something like that. You know, that's dropping some serious lettuce. So, I mean, it's just a reminder of how some people in this country live. And, you know, we don't even realize that there are a lot of the time that there are people living in that kind of stratosphere. But anyway, that's aside the point.
I mean, I will say in context, Sam, the first scene of this movie where there's just these people like talking about buying, you know, tens of thousands of dollars of jewelry in a single visit to the store, it was really foreign to me. I cannot imagine spending that much money on anything. And I was like asking Neil and Jess, like, does this really happen? Are there people who live like this? And I guess there must be.
Yeah, I mean, that's why Kevin Garnett's got like a crew around him, right? Is because, you know, I just looked up his net worth. Kevin Garnett's worth like $120 million. You know, he can go in and buy whatever the hell he wants, right? So
Yeah, I guess if I had like $10,000 of pocket money, there are other things I would buy first. But
right. Yeah,
different strokes.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Is there anything we don't like about this movie, off the top of our heads?
I mean, in my review, I will have to land, like, I don't know if it's for me or I would want to watch it again or even recommend it, but hard to deny how well executed the vision is.
Right. That's kind of where I'm at with it. Like, there are movies that I like more on just like a personal level, but in terms of what they were going for and how well it was executed, it's hard not to think of it as anything but a 4 or a 5 for me. And again, you just get so wrapped up in it. If there's anything I don't like, I think the stuff with the wife and the family is like a little less interesting than all the stuff that's going down in the, like, in his actual business.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I suppose you need that stuff.
Need them to humanize him. Yeah. Give him something to, like, crawl back to.
Yeah.
And a little more depth, too, with, like, Arno and his relationship, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting watching him, like, kind of make it work for those moments when he's around the table with his family. I think like that just skating by is part of an important part of his personality. Go ahead, Neil. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think the wife and kids. I mean, so A, I think the oldest son is interesting in that like he's clearly like emulating his father in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, like the family, I think is more important as a plot device than his characters. In that, like, it's, you know, it's one thing for you to destroy yourself. It's another thing when people depend on you and you're destroying yourself.
Yeah.
And I think that might be kind of why, like Nicolas Cage's character in Leaving Las Vegas is more relatable to me than Adam Sandler's is here.
Because Adam Sandler has a family.
Nicolas Cage is destroying himself, but I guess he had a ex-wife and kid.
But we don't really see him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not like this.
But instead, like.
I see what you mean.
We're actively seeing the effects of his actions on them. Like when he's trying to put his youngest son to bed, instead of actually doing his job, he just like lays down on the floor,
right,
and watches the game on his phone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I like that you guys brought the comparison to Leaving Las Vegas. I think that's really apt and really observant to say that. Yeah, they're actually somewhat similar movies, but it's like the one is created with the tone of alcoholism and is set in the perfect place for that particular addiction, right? Las Vegas. And New York City is absolutely the best setting in the world for an anxiety ridden gambling addiction movie. I think they would be a really interesting double feature.
Yeah.
You would probably never walk away from.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then you close it out with Requiem for a Dream or something.
Oh God. Right. Yeah.
Decision movie trio.
Yeah. Favorite scenes, guys?
Yeah, you guys go first.
I gotta think for a minute.
I love the scene where she's his mistress is like texting him a bunch of sexy shit in the apartment, and he's inside the closet. It reminded me a lot of Blue Velvet.
Honestly, that's funny. And it's like, I mean, his name is so perfect, Howard Ratner. It's like you would be doing this type of weird preachy shit.
I'll say the Passover scene. So much interesting stuff happens there. Besides, like the real treatment of Jewish culture. You get to see him like acting normal or almost normal with his family. He's trying to impress them. He's pulling it off very briefly, you know, before things go off the rails. Really interesting.
How about you, Neil? You go ahead, Neil.
You know, I think that ending sequence is just so well done. And like literally, like I let out a breath of relief when he got shot in the face. I was just like, oh my God. I think that's somewhat intentional.
Yeah.
I agree. Yeah. Like you're finally not like trapped in this guy's mind and like, everything.
We are the guys stuck in the security gate. We're just along for the ride until we finally get our agency back.
Dude, that is exactly what I said to Grace when all the guys in there were watching the game and they were sweating their asses off. I was like, that's us. Like that is the audience of this. It's like weirdly voyeuristic.
That's just like, how you feel when sports are on, right, Sam?
I guess it seems voyeuristic to me because I don't have that personal relation to watching sports. But yeah, absolutely. But I think there is something intentional about like exactly as Neil said that like they are meant to represent us because they're standing by and they're watching it and they can't do anything about it and they're all just sweating and nervous as hell. Anyway, that's a great pick too. That last scene was phenomenal. Grace actually like had a pretty, I don't want to say it was somewhere between a scream and a gasp when Adam Sandler got shot in the face.
And then I forgot even on this rewatch, fucking Arno gets shot too. It's like the thing that'd been chasing him the whole time basically is dead too, and it's not like everything the whole movie was about is dead now because those people are dead.
Except the mistress who has like a
$1.1 million
ticket in her hand.
Right, right.
She drives out with the cash. She's set.
Does she get it, or if it's in his name, what happens there?
I would think she got it because it was cash, right?
Yeah, because remember the creepy helicopter pilot walks out with the bags and hands it to her.
Mm-hmm. And then she
did. It just depends. Yeah, I don't know. I would just think it depends. Yeah, it's interesting.
Who was that guy?
Probably gets it.
Was there any more to who that helicopter pilot guy was?
I think he was just a guy that happened to be in that blade with her. I don't. Right. Was he the pilot? I don't fully remember.
I don't think he was the pilot.
He might have just been maybe they were like a ride share.
Okay.
Yeah, right.
Well, if you've got the scratch for it, absolutely. Yeah. You know?
I thought she just met him in the casino.
No, they met in the helicopter.
He was on that helicopter.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's like when Taylor Swift needs a midnight snack.
Literally. a couple of my favorite scenes, and even more so with her like getting the money at the end, is like her showing off her ass tattoo of Howie's name and him like breaking down saying like I'm not worth it is so funny, like probably one of the funniest moments in the movie for me. The whole like crazy chaos scene, not quite at the end, but when like Damani's getting pissed at him and he's like talking to the doctor, and then like Flawless is at the door, and then the fish are getting poisoned, and I just love that quick like rapid fire line where he's like, Jews and colon cancer. I thought we were supposed to be the chosen
the chosen one.
I was like, oh my god.
The line that really just blew me away was then where the doctor responds, hey man, colon cancer paid for my vacation.
Oh my god.
I was actually offended by that line.
Damn.
smartly done, but it was just, again, just like, oh my
god. Just cuts it, yeah.
Yeah. There are some truly reprehensible people in this movie. Go ahead, Gideon.
I don't know how they do the like graphics or visuals on the really cool zoom in, zoom out at the beginning and end, but I love that mixed with the like cool synthy soundtrack. I think it works really well.
Can I interject one?
Yeah.
Okay, so I want to see if anybody else noticed this, because it could have just been like my angle on the TV. But when things are like looking up for Howard, the special garnet stone or opal stone that he keeps trying to get back, that's when like the inner light shines and it looks crazy and like it's a cool piece. But when he finally gets it back and like after the auction, like he owes his father-in-law like $200,000. And he pulls it out of the box, and it doesn't shine anymore. And then when he like all of a sudden gets the, you know, when he sells it to Kevin Garnett, I feel like it starts to shine again. And I thought I noticed that, but I don't know if that was just me or if that was. So I just wanted your guys' take on that.
I see it when you say it in retrospect. I would have to watch closer next time to see if that, you know,
agree.
It does align for me.
I also felt that there was some, I don't want to say supernatural, but it was almost like the opal was like whoever was in possession of it throughout the movie was having like unusually good luck.
I mean, do have that brief moment, speaking of symbols in the play or in the movie, when they're watching his daughter's play. And the crux of the play is that these like goblins or something give her a blessing, and the blessing is that every time she talks, like coins spill out of her mouth so that she can't speak to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
There's some symbolism there, right? Like,
yeah, it definitely. It's one of those like I'm not smart enough to know what it is, but I'm smart enough to recognize that it's there and it's artfully done, right?
There's something going on, right?
Yeah. I see what you guys are doing here with this whole money shit. Okay. Well, we're coming up on about a little bit more than 50 minutes here. Does anybody want to give their final rating or have any final thoughts?
I'm going to go 4-4. I think it's perfectly executed. I don't know that I want to watch it many, many more times, but for what they were doing, I think they did it, and it was compelling.
Yeah, I think I'm going to go with a 4 as well, not because I think there's anything particularly wrong with it. I think they executed on their vision nigh perfectly. I just think it's like
wait,
Neil's
aren't we out of a 4 scale? I tried to give it the best rating.
Oh no, I think we're on a 5 scale now because it works with Letterboxd better.
5, just no half stars.
I'm so confused.
That's okay.
I've done like 2 or 3 things like this week. On Monday, I thought it was like next week. Anyway,
do you want to move it up to a 5?
God, I don't know. Strong 4, very strong 4.
Okay, I'm gonna go with a strong 4 as well. Something that Neil said several weeks ago is that like sometimes you just got to leave room for 7 samurai. You know what I mean? Like that's kind of how I feel. It's like there's nothing wrong with this movie. I really, really liked it, but you got to leave room for the creme de la creme. You know, the ones that really hit you in a personal way. So that's where I'm gonna go. Yeah, I'm gonna presume Gideon, you're a 5-star on this one.
Yeah, this is maybe a top 10 for me. I definitely agree with what you guys are saying about like saving the 5. And I'm sure I rate movies way too high with some of my personal picks. But this one, yeah, it just really hits on a lot of different notes for me. It has a lot of crazy, cool things going on. And I love showing this movie to people who haven't seen it. Even if they're like the slightest fan of like Adam Sandler or just like crazy thrill ride movies. So.
How about you, Neil?
Yeah, I think I'd give this one a strong 3. Like Alex said, I don't know if I ever want to really go back and watch the whole thing. Maybe some like YouTube clips of it, but I don't think I'd want to watch the whole thing anytime soon. But it's, again, 100% worth it. 100% worth watching at least once.
That's totally fair. Yeah.
Okay. Now that we're about ready to wrap things up, I will do my one word impression of Adam Sandler for you guys, if you're ready.
Ready.
All right, ready? A shabadoo.
Nice.
Okay. Anyway.
I'm golf clapping.
Thank you.
Oh, last thing I wanted to mention. Yeah. Does this movie not seem to be like a biopic about a side character in GTA 4? Because I feel like that's what this totally. Movie is like
yeah.
Some character in GTA 4.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, I get you. Like, the anxiousness and just, like, the over-the-topness could totally be, like, any GTA side character that you do, like, 5 missions for before they get shot in the head by a bigger, badder guy.
I can imagine being the GTA character trapped in the glass door and, like, banging on the fucking door.
Right, yeah, totally. I totally agree with that. Well, I have a suggestion for next week, but Alex Princeton, you're going to be out, right?
That's right, I'm out. And then I think Gideon is out 2 weeks after that, right?
Yeah, I'm going to be out on April 10th and probably April 17th.
Well, the last time...
I think you guys should just go without me so that we don't have like a 3-week gap.
Sure. Well... Yeah, we can do, you know, we'll do an episode without you and then we'll do a couple without Gideon and we'll, the last time that you were out and it was just me, Gideon, and Neil doing a movie, I made these guys watch Midnight in Paris. We all know how that turned out.
Well, we should find another, you know, bad film that you're mistaken about.
Yeah, exactly. I was like thinking like how specifically I could torture these guys. So I want to, for my next suggestion, I was thinking either American Graffiti or what was the other one that I had on the tip of my tongue that I really wanted to do?
Is that the body horror one?
No. I decided that I wanted to do David Cronenberg's Videodrome.
Ooh, I haven't seen it.
Nice. It's in the Criterion Collection and David Cronenberg is known as the master of body horror and I like torturing Neil. So we're gonna see where this takes us. I'm really excited to watch it. The lead actor is James Woods, aka Hades from Hercules.
Ooh, nice.
And Debbie Harry is in this, so I don't know a whole lot else about it. I just know that it involves David Cronenberg, so you know, there will be some crazy shit that happens. What's up?
Last final thing. Howard Ratner's wife in this movie is also Elsa from Frozen. So fun fact.
Yeah, she was. Hey, Grace, which the wife in Uncut Gems was? Isn't she in? She's in Wicked.
Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah.
Yeah, she's one of the witches in Wicked as well. So that makes sense.
She was great. I loved her.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. Well, guys, this was a good episode. Guess we're going to hop off here now and play some World of Warcraft. And
oh, yeah.
We'll get rocking on Videodrome for next week. My apologies to Neil ahead of time. And all right, I'll see everybody next week.
Later. Good, boys. Later.